Jimmy Carter, the 39th president of the United States, has died.
I think that the first thing that everybody's going to remember about Jimmy Carter is that he lived a long life doing a lot for a lot of different people.
A fiery plane crash in South Korea.
Investigators have not said what caused this incident. They're looking into the possibility of poor weather conditions, also the possibility of a bird strike that may have decapacitated the landing gear.
And the contradictions of Donald Trump's energy plan.
We don't really have means to force companies to drill for more oil. And often, you know, investors will have their own concerns about, well, if we have too much oil production, prices might drop.
Today is Monday, December 30th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. We begin the show with some sad news. Jimmy Carter, the 39th U.S. president who rose from life as a peanut farmer to become the top U.S. leader and later went on to earn a Nobel Peace Prize after leaving the White House, died on Sunday afternoon in his home in the small town of Plains, Georgia, at the age of 100. VOA's Kane Farbaugh filed this report on Carter's legacy.
I, Jimmy Carter, do solemnly swear.
When Jimmy Carter took the oath of office on January 20th, 1977, he promised a government as good as its people.
There can be no nobler nor more ambitious task for America to undertake on this day of a new beginning than to help shape a just and peaceful world.
A world he continued to shape beyond his single term in the White House, becoming a Nobel Peace Prize laureate, heading the global nonprofit, the Carter Center, whose mission is waging peace, fighting disease, and building hope.
I look upon the Carter Center work as an extension of what I try to do as president.
Carter was born in Plains, Georgia in 1924. He graduated from the U.S. Naval Academy in 1946, serving as a submarine officer before returning to Plains in 1953 to run the family farm in the wake of his father's death. Carter entered politics during the civil rights movement of the 1960s, serving two terms as a Georgia legislator before becoming the state's governor in 1971.
I say to you quite frankly that the time for racial discrimination is over.
Carter went from being an unknown Southern governor in 1971 to the winning presidential candidate in 1976, narrowly defeating Republican Gerald Ford. Mediating the 1979 Camp David Accords and the eventual peace treaty between Egypt and Israel was the pinnacle of Carter's presidency.
There had been four wars between Arabs and Israelis in the previous 25 years, with the Egyptians in the leadership, supported by the Soviet Union. They were the only country that could really challenge Israel militarily.
Carter also negotiated a treaty returning control of the Panama Canal to Panama, and established full diplomatic ties with the People's Republic of China. But the 1979 Islamic Revolution in Iran would change the course of his presidency. Protests led by Shiite clerics toppled the U.S.-backed Shah, who fled the country. Militants later stormed the U.S. Embassy in Tehran, taking 66 Americans hostage. In late November of that year, 13 hostages were released. In April 1980, Carter authorized a military operation to free the remaining hostages. It failed, and 8 U.S. service members died. Carter also faced challenges at home. Inflation and rising unemployment hobbled the economy, contributing to his 1980 election defeat to Republican Ronald Reagan. On January 20, 1981, Reagan's inauguration day, Iran finally freed the American hostages. Carter, defeated and depressed, returned to Plains to plan his presidential library.
I envisioned to be a tiny thing where I would have an office and some nice buildings in Atlanta.
It became much more. A well-known global nonprofit, the Carter Center has monitored over 100 elections and mediated disputes ranging from a nuclear standoff with North Korea in 1994 to a peace agreement between Uganda and Sudan. The center also promotes health and fights illness in the poorest parts of the planet. Eradicating guinea worm disease has been a primary goal, with just 13 human cases reported in 2022, the lowest number yet.
There's only been one disease in the history of humankind ever eradicated, and that was smallpox more than 30 years ago. So guinea worm is going to soon be the second disease in history to be wiped off the face of the earth.
Carter's work helping humanity led to Oslo, Norway in 2002, where he accepted the Nobel Peace Prize.
When I won the Nobel Peace Prize, for instance, it was because of the work of the Carter Center. So I would be perfectly satisfied to have a legacy based on peace and human rights. I mean, who would?
Carter led an active life into his 90s, surviving brain cancer in 2015. But declining health and the 2020 global coronavirus pandemic kept him confined to his hometown of Plains in his final years. In one of his last public media appearances, Carter shared with VOA his hopes for the future.
I would like to see the United States in the future strive to be the number one champion in the world of peace and human rights and environmental equality. And I would say treating everybody equal. If we could do that, we'd have a real superpower in a country that I love very much.
Carter lived the longest of any occupant of the White House, and his 76-year marriage to wife Rosalynn is the longest of any president and first lady. Kane Faerbaugh, VOA News, Plains, Georgia.
In a statement released Sunday evening in Washington, President Joe Biden said about Carter that, with his compassion and moral clarity, he worked to eradicate disease, forge peace, advance civil rights and human rights, promote free and fair elections, house the homeless, and always advocate for the least among us. He saved, lifted, and changed the lives of people all across the globe, and that he was a man of great character and courage, hope, and optimism. President-elect Donald Trump said on social media that those of us who have been fortunate to have served as president understand this is a very exclusive club, and only we can relate to the enormous responsibility of leading the greatest nation in history. The challenges Jimmy faced as president came at a pivotal time in our country, and he did everything in his power to improve the lives of all Americans. For that, we all owe him a debt of gratitude. Now for a deeper look at the life and legacy of Jimmy Carter, I'm joined by Kane Faerbaugh.
I think that the first thing that everybody's going to remember about Jimmy Carter is that he lived a long life doing a lot for a lot of different people, building houses, promoting health around the world, and also an advocate for democracy and an advocate for peace. I think he's going to be remembered more for what he did when he wasn't in the White House or what happened after he was in the White House.
Is that common for a former president to have such an active life after the presidency?
Jimmy Carter's post-presidential career is in many ways unprecedented and perhaps difficult to follow throughout history. He lived the longest of any U.S. president outside the White House. He lived the longest of any U.S. president. He reached the age of 100. He's the only U.S. president to do that. Just because of President Carter's longevity, it's going to be difficult to do what he did. But not just that, he did so much for so long. He was extremely active until he was about 96 or 97 years old, and he left the White House in his mid-50s. So he had almost four decades of activity in which he built houses with Habitat for Humanity. He worked with the Carter Center around the world, addressing neglected tropical diseases like guinea worm. And, you know, he also promoted peace. He helped orchestrate a peace agreement between Sudan and Uganda. And that's just, you know, the tip of the iceberg. There's so much that he accomplished in those four decades after he left the White House.
Now, when he did leave the White House, he was a one-term president. He was defeated by Ronald Reagan in the 1980 election in a landslide. He wasn't so popular then, certainly not as popular as he is now. What were the 1980s like for him, and how did that perspective change?
Well, his vice president, Walter Mondale, was the Democratic nominee for president in 1984. Conspicuously, President Carter didn't really do a lot of active campaigning for his one-time vice president, Walter Mondale. And that's probably because President Carter wasn't someone who most Americans look to with a lot of favorability. There's a lot of reasons for that. Most Americans will remember the Iran hostage crisis. Also, inflation was high. There was also gasoline and petroleum issues, the lack of availability. So there was just a series of issues that Carter had to contend with in the White House that ultimately left this impression with Americans that they were better off without him as president. And so He was sort of in the wilderness. He was out there trying to figure out what he wanted to do. Now, one thing he was successful about when he was president was the Camp David peace accords between Egypt and Israel. And so President Carter wanted to base his post-presidential career and his library and museum effectively on the model of peace and democracy that he used to help orchestrate the Camp David peace accords. And so the Carter Center was founded to be that vehicle for him. And that's what he spent the 1980s basically creating, founding, setting into motion, and then figuring out what that organization was going to do.
Now, you had covered President Carter for a long time. You've spoken to him many times. What's he like when the cameras aren't rolling?
He is as genuine in person and privately as he is in public. President Carter is a man who was always on time. He's someone who appreciated punctuality. And so I knew that if we were going to have an appointment or we were going to wind up being engaged or I was going to have some event where I was going to be with him, I wasn't going to be late because President Carter, I think it's the military sensibility he had after serving as an officer in the Navy, that he was punctual and always wanted to be on time. But he was always kind and he was always someone who wanted to understand or know more about something that was interesting, the person he was talking to. I mean, I think that he made you feel like you were in his orbit when you were talking to him. And, you know, obviously our topics of discussion would range from, you know, the starting pitching rotation for the Atlanta Braves, his favorite baseball team, to his concerns about getting to the end of eradicating guinea worm from the planet. I mean, the topics that we would speak about would be varied and interesting. And it doesn't matter, whatever the conversation was, President Carter was genuinely interested in knowing your perspective as much as he wanted to express his perspective to you.
Sure sounds like it. We'll leave it there for today. VOA's Kane Farbaugh on the life and legacy of Jimmy Carter. Kane, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
The other top story we're following today comes from Muan, South Korea. That's where an airliner skid off the runway and crashed into a concrete barrier, bursting into flames. Initial reports are that 179 of the 181 passengers were killed, and the two survivors are in very serious condition. VOA's Bill Gallo has more from Seoul.
A tragedy in southern South Korea when a Cheju Air flight carrying 181 people crashed. We don't yet have the details, but the video that has emerged is quite disturbing. It appears to show the plane failing to deploy its landing gear as it travels at a very high rate of speed down the runway at this small airport in southern South Korea before crashing into a fence at the end of the runway and exploding in a ball of flames. Investigators have not said what caused this incident. They're looking into the possibility of poor weather conditions, also the possibility of a bird strike that may have decapacitated the landing gear. Many of these Koreans were presumably returning home from vacation, from holidays in Bangkok, Thailand. And at this point, media reports indicate that only two people were pulled from that plane alive. A terrible tragedy for a country already experiencing lots of political turmoil in recent weeks. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul, South Korea.
And here are some other stories we're following from around the world. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un said that he will implement the, quote, toughest anti-U.S. policy less than a month before Donald Trump takes office as U.S. president. This according to the country's state media. Kim said that the U.S., South Korea-Japan security partnership is expanding into a nuclear military bloc for aggression. The handful of remaining Jews in Syria can again make pilgrimages to one of the world's oldest synagogues, first built 720 years before the Common Era. Syria was once home to one of the world's largest Jewish communities. Those numbers have shrunk dramatically, especially after the State of Israel was created in 1948. Today, it is believed that only 9 Jews remain in Syria. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Karish. Looking now at American politics and the upcoming presidential transition. President-elect Trump is taking a different approach to energy than his predecessor. It's all part of his promise to bring down the cost of living for Americans. But can it work? As VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson reports, Trump's plans could be complicated by the complex interdependence on oil and gas supplies.
A signature campaign promise in August from then Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump.
Our effort to bring the cost of living under control will be the all-out push to end the Biden-Harris war on a thing called American energy. American energy. We will drill, baby, drill.
Is set to become a top priority when the now president-elect is sworn into office on January 20th. Trump aims to boost oil supplies by speeding up permits for drilling and increasing oil exploration off the U.S. coastline. Some analysts say that move could get pushback from oil companies. James Coleman is a law professor and expert in energy law and infrastructure at University of Minnesota.
We don't really have means to force countries, to force companies to drill for more oil. And often, you know, investors will have their own concerns about, well, if we have too much oil production, prices might drop.
Trump has also proposed expanding exports of LNG, liquefied natural gas. Qatar's energy minister Saeed Sharida Al-Kaabi said earlier this month he had no concerns about Trump's pledge to lift a cap on LNG exports.
Additional LNG and additional competition is welcome. At the end, you know, even if you open up LNG and say we're going to export another 300 million tons from the U.S. or 500 million tons from the U.S., all these projects are driven by private enterprises that look at the commercial viability of projects.
Trump's pick to lead the Department of Energy, Chris Wright, the CEO of an oil field services firm, clashed with Democratic Congressman Sean Casten earlier this year over his statements about climate change.
You said there is no climate crisis. We're not in the midst of an energy transition either. Humans and complex life are simply impossible without carbon dioxide. The idea of carbon pollution is outrageous. You agree you said all those things?
Absolutely.
Okay. It's all...
Which
we could
wrong?
Get into
which
it.
One of those...
Many of Trump's energy plans cannot be accomplished without cooperation from the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries and other oil producers. Again, James Coleman.
We export a lot of energy products to both Canada and Mexico. And so if there were reciprocal tariffs from those countries, that could have a negative impact on our producers. So you know, I think most of the energy industry is hoping that this is just the opening salvo.
In a stark contrast to the Biden administration, which prioritized renewable energy and combating climate change, Trump is also expected to cut tax credits for electric vehicles. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Washington.
Mikhail Kalashvili, a hardline critic of the West, was sworn in as president of Georgia on Sunday, sparking major protests in Tbilisi, Georgia's capital. It all follows the election victory of the Georgian Dream Party, which opposition figures and Western powers say was fraudulent. Reuters' David Doyle has that story.
Clashes broke out between police and protesters in Georgia's capital Tbilisi on Sunday as the country's new president was sworn in amid a political crisis. Opponents of Mikhail Kavelashvili have been protesting since October over a disputed parliamentary election and a move by his ruling Georgian Dream Party to freeze application talks for membership of the European Union. A hardline critic of the West, Kavelashvili has repeatedly accused Western intelligence agencies of plotting to drive Georgia into war with neighboring Russia. After his swearing-in ceremony, he said, quote, "The Georgian people have always understood that peace is the main prerequisite for survival and development." Outgoing president Salome Zurabishvili gave a defiant speech to supporters as she left the presidential palace, saying Kavelashvili had no legitimacy as leader. "I am taking legitimacy with me," she said. "I am taking the flag with me. I am taking your trust with me." Pro-EU Zurabishvili said lawmakers who chose the new president were elected in an October parliamentary election that was marred by fraud. Local and international election monitors have said violations could have affected the results, and Western countries have called for an investigation. But Georgian Dream and the country's election commission say that the October election was free and fair. Georgia's four main pro-EU opposition parties have since boycotted parliament. They say Zurabishvili will remain the legitimate president until fresh elections are held. Police have cracked down on protests with over 400 people, including senior opposition leaders, detained. The presidential standoff is seen as a watershed moment in Georgia. The mountainous country of 3.7 million people had until recently been regarded as among the most democratic and pro-Western of the former Soviet states. The country has a long-standing national goal of joining the EU that is written into its constitution.
That's Reuters' David Doyle reporting. Mozambique is also having a political crisis following a contested election. The situation at its southern border with South Africa has become increasingly volatile, affecting trade and travel. It's forced South Africa and neighboring Eswatini to collaborate to find a solution to the growing crisis on the border, with the Manango border post serving as a makeshift lifeline for those seeking passage from Mozambique. Noo Kanye Musi reports from Eswatini's capital, Mbabane.
Escalating violence in Mozambique has forced trade and travel to be diverted from neighboring South Africa's Lebombo border post to Eswatini's Mananga border post. Michael Masiapato, commissioner of South Africa's Border Management Authority, told VOA that although authorities are managing the crisis, it continues to pose significant challenges.
The corridor from Rasen Garcia here, Lebombo Rasen Garcia to Maputo, is around 120 kilometers. So even on that basis, when they deploy the military and when they deploy police officers on the corridor, it is not able to cover each and every area. And I think you will fairly be aware of the nature of the protest that side. It is very much sporadic and it is very much widespread. The biggest challenge that we have on the Mozambican side is that the corridor has a lot of your townships around it, your Madola, as it were, and all of those towards the port. So on that basis, even their presence, they are not able to guarantee.
Following presidential candidate Daniel Chapo's controversial election victory Monday, Mozambique has been plunged into turmoil, leaving scores dead amid violent protests. Some analysts have expressed concern that continued political violence could destabilize regional security and impede economic development, sparking weapons proliferation and criminal activity. Solomon Mondlane, a political analyst in Mozambique, told VOA he is cautiously optimistic that South African and European efforts can help defuse the situation.
The situation is volatile. The good news is we're hearing more calls from different countries, from South Africa, from other European countries, calling for more dialogue. South Africa has come out to say they're willing to facilitate a dialogue.
Levin Dor, a South African political analyst and lecturer at Tshwane University of Technology in Johannesburg, said he believes regional players' efforts at dialogue with the Mozambican government are encouraging signs that many in the region are seeking peace and stability.
Already there are efforts to deal with the crisis in Mozambique. Minister Ronald Lamola of the Republic of South Africa has already started with the initiatives of having discussions with the government of Mozambique. And those are the efforts that appears to be supported by many people who want to see peace and stability in that area. Of course, if the situation gets out of hand, it will therefore require the intervention of SADC in order to ensure that there is peace, there is stability, and indeed, there is economic activity that is going on.
Zimbabwe's president, Emmerson Mnangagwa, who is chairing the Southern African Development Community, or SADC, has said the regional bloc is ready to assist Mozambique engulfed in post-election violence that has claimed more than 100 protesters' lives. Noo Kanye Musi, VOA News, Mbabane, Eswatini.
And that's going to wrap it up for us today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Steve Karish.
We'll be right back.